Welcome to In Season, where we explore the farms and gardens of the Lower Columbia Pacific region. I'm your host, Teresa Retzloff, and in the studio with me today is a dear friend, Caitlin McGuire. Caitlin's a native of this region, grew up over in on the Washington side of the Columbia River, and I first met you a few years ago when you came in and helped out on our farm for a season, and I was immediately struck by she was just captivated me. I was so just engaged in her conversation. She had gone back east to university, worked on some farms across the country, and farming was definitely in her blood, but she also had a passion for international studies and connecting with other cultures. And we used to have these very intense conversations in the greenhouse. You know, we were weeding and tidying up tomatoes and philosophizing about the bigger picture. And I recently reconnected with Caitlin. She came back to the area, and I wanted to hear more about some of the stuff that she'd been doing, and to talk a bit about the connections to the land that we all have. So welcome, Caitlin.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So tell us a little bit about where you grew up here in the Pacific Northwest region.
Yeah. So I'm a proud NASEL High School graduate.
Yay, NASEL High!
And simultaneously also spent a lot of time in my teenage years over here because I went to Clatsop Community College through the Running Start program that Washington State has. And I also, in my very much earlier years, grew up in King County, right off the Cedar River watershed, which also left quite an impression on me.
And did you grow up gardening? I mean, were your parents gardeners? Did you connect to the land in that way at all?
Yeah, my mom was a big gardener. We lived on a really swampy piece of old growth. Right. Yep.
And she gardened on that. I mean, that's impressive. That's
a
skill set.
Yeah. No, it definitely was impressive. Particularly, she was a big dahlia enthusiast, but she also grew lots of vegetable crops and berry crops, and we kept chickens and had goats for a short time, and neighbors had cows. And she also had me grow up canning and preserving and making just about everything from scratch. So I had a real connection to where my food was coming from.
Did you enjoy doing that when you were a kid? I always wonder if you grow up doing that, is it seen as a chore or is that something that you actually enjoy doing?
I mean, I'm sure there's some debate, but I now have happy memories.
Well, and those are skills you have now.
Yeah, and they're skills I have. And I make a pretty big effort to try to can every year when I have access to vegetables and fresh produce.
I was speaking as someone who did not grow up learning how to do those things and had to teach myself. I'm always so envious of people that learned that as they were growing up because it just seems like such an amazing skill to just have in your back pocket. So that's great. So after high school, after Clatsop Community College, where did you go?
Yeah, so after I graduated high school, I went to school in Boston, and I went to a school that was pretty close to Fenway Park on the Charles River, Boston University, which is a liberal arts school, and then got a four-year education out there.
And what did you study?
I studied international relations with a focus on environment and development economics in sub-Saharan Africa, and I have a degree in cultural anthropology as well.
So what drew you to Africa? What made you think about that? Because this wasn't a place that you hadn't visited Africa.
No, certainly not. Man, I spent a lot of time goofing off.
No, not as...
I mean...
Admit this now. Okay,
I spent a lot of time goofing off in kind of independent study periods, reading newspapers in the library in NASEL High School. I just have very visceral memories of doing that. And I made an effort to have independent study classes where I could read in the library because the librarian at the time, Miss Dearmore, who I think now works at the South Bend School District, was very tolerant of my voracious reading habits. And I spent a lot of time, for some particular reason, kind of being drawn to international news stories. And so that's kind of initially where that interest grew out of.
So you picked up some farming experience, I know, on your way back west. You worked on a farm. Was it in Montana?
Yes.
And how long were you there?
I was there 8 months because I loved it so much. I stayed past the growing season and ended up working for an apple farmer who was doing kind of the winter sort of his fall harvest.
So, and you just kind of, what drew you to doing that? I mean, just because farming isn't something that necessarily someone who's studying international relations would just go, hey, I want to go work on a farm.
Yeah.
What brought you back to that to that?
Yeah. I spent a lot of time studying food policy and in kind of an environmental issues that had a global kind of scale and impact. And through that, I kind of realized there was a lot of knowledge I was just missing and kind of not knowing what people's lives look like who lived in agrarian economies look like day to day. And I also, some of my first jobs out here on the coast were related to the fishing industry, and particularly in the 2000s, there were some kind of sustainable fisheries that were emerging. So I'd always been really interested in kind of food trends and how people and communities connect to the land that they live in, and what kind of stewardship people do to their immediate surrounding environment.
I have to say, I'm really impressed that your instinct in thinking about, you're studying larger food policy issues, but your instinct was to go and learn about, you know, like the lives of farmers and the people who actually produce the food. Because I feel like that's often so missing from people who are making food policy, that they've never actually been on the production side of it. And so they're making decisions that will affect those people and affect how farmers can do their work, but they've never actually farmed. And so they don't know firsthand what some of the challenges or issues that might, you know, make a farm successful or not successful, what those firsthand might be. So that's great experience that can really inform you going forward. So you did, I think I met you shortly after that. Because I know you spent a season helping out on our farm, and I have to say that I don't think I've ever laughed quite so much during a farm season. We had a lot of fun out in the field, and Caitlin was just a joy to work with. And your pleasure at growing things and harvesting and processing was just very inspiring. I really loved connecting with you about that. And then you left, and I was heartbroken but also excited for you because I knew that you were going off to good adventures. And you did finally get to Africa.
Yes. So that was actually not the first initial time, but I did do Peace Corps following my year here at the Northwest Coast, and I did Peace Corps in Ethiopia. And I was actually given a choice of which country I could choose, and I did specifically choose Ethiopia, and that grew out of having been to East Africa in college for a semester, and I studied in Nairobi and traveled to Tanzania and Rwanda and Uganda as well, and was really just struck by how varied so much of that region is, and it really lit a spark in my curiosity about the region. So I was really happy to go back.
And these are cultures where, I mean, they're much more agrarian than ours. I mean, there's a lot more farming. There's a lot more working the land and people living much more closely to where their food is produced. And you saw a lot more of that firsthand?
Absolutely, yeah. So even in my semester in Kenya, even though I lived in Nairobi, I did make an effort to do some field study projects and worked with two different communities, one out on the coast and one in the northern country, that were both agrarian communities. And then I specifically was a environment agriculture extension worker with the Peace Corps in Ethiopia. And Ethiopia is about 85% agrarian, meaning 85% of their population is employed or gets their household income or is somehow involved with growing their own food or raising their own livestock.
That is, I mean, that's amazing when you think about it. I think in the United States, it's like 1% or something or less. I mean, it's a tiny, tiny percentage.
It's even here. Different compared to the rest of the region.
Yeah.
Particularly Kenya has a lower percentage than that as they have very quickly growing urban cities in Kenya.
And would you think in Ethiopia, is it more subsistence farming? Is it people growing food for themselves, or is it like larger food production?
It is, in my experience. There's obvious, it's really different in the different regions in Ethiopia, and that has a lot to do with elevation. Makes a huge difference in Ethiopia, and it's really, the topography is so varied. The Rift Valley does run through it, and it has the Dunkal Depression, which I believe is nicknamed one of the lowest places, hottest places on Earth. It has huge salt flats, extremely hot, very similar geologically to Death Valley, I would guess, is the most analogous thing in the U.S. And I, however, lived on top of a mountain at 12,000 feet, on top of a mountainous steppe, and I was nearly on the equator but could see frost. And so obviously those are two hugely different areas, and people make livings in very different ways. So maybe in the Dakhal Depression, there would be camel farmers, but there were no camel farmers where I lived, and my people were kind of known as the horse people because everyone was able to have a horse because they could graze on the high mountain steps.
God, what an experience. That's so amazing. So what fascinated me when we reconnected recently is you were talking about work that you did when you came back, and you got connected in Idaho to working with a refugee garden. Can you explain what that was? And like what that project was?
Yeah. So that project was a subsidiary office of the Idaho Office for Refugees. It's a program called Global Gardens. And they run both a refugee farmer entrepreneurial program. And they also run a variety of urban agriculture plots.
And how would you, I mean, when you say urban agriculture, that not directly related to refugees, but just open to anyone? Or
no.
It was still focused on refugees?
It's all generally related to refugees, since their funding is coming through the Idaho Office for Refugees. And generally, those urban agriculture plots were either donated by the city of Boise, but more often related to a faith-based community. So, for example, different churches would donate a parcel of their land, or the synagogue donated a parcel of their land as well.
So, and these would be like just basically a community garden, like what people are familiar with, where everyone has a plot, a small bed.
Yes.
That would be theirs to grow whatever they want. But these were generally focused on refugees. And would you have people from all different cultures and countries?
Yeah, absolutely. You did see there are socioeconomic differences between the refugees. They all come from various parts of the world and have various ways that they enter the U.S. I'm using the term refugee pretty broadly, but were seeking asylum in the U.S., et cetera. Lost my train of thought.
Thinking about, like, you know, all the different people, the threads of people that came together in these gardens. And then coordinating, because that's also a thing, too, where if you have people from all over the world working together in a garden and they don't all speak the same languages.
Yeah. Yeah, you did.
And you might not speak their language.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. That was an issue. But I think the common experience of growing food is pretty universal, and especially eating food as nourishment and as a connection to your home country was something that they could all recognize as a shared experience.
Were there crops that were common? I mean, did you see that people grew the same things?
Absolutely.
Regardless of where they came from?
Yeah. So much maize was grown, much sometimes to the chart again of us Americans who kind of view corn as a not very exciting vegetable crop.
But that's really become common.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's amazing.
And that has a lot to do with kind of globalization and the way our food system has changed in the past 100 years. But you did see a lot of enthusiasm for some things that I had never thought people were so enthusiastic about, for example, eggplant, which in my kind of American experience for American farmers is usually a pretty tough sell.
It's a little bit of an exotic. I have serious eggplant fans from our farm, but a lot of people are like, what is that and why would I want to cook that?
Yeah, it's pretty prolific too for the period of time it does grow. So I definitely have a file folder on my desktop that says 99 problems, eggplant. This is full of various recipes for eggplant.
We have to talk because I think I need those recipes. Okay, let's pause on the eggplant thought. I just want to take a short break to remind people that they are listening to you, are listening, our dear listeners, are listening to Coast Community Radio at KMUN Astoria 91.9 FM and KTCB Tillamook at 89.5 FM. And we're streaming live at coastradio.org. And if you are just joining us for In Season this morning, I am speaking with Washington native Caitlin McGuire. She was born and raised, NASAL High graduate, but has traveled the world and has done a lot of different things connected to food and farming. And we're talking right now about her work with refugees and refugee gardens in Boise, Idaho. And I think what struck me about this, Caitlin and I reconnected recently, and I was thinking about your work with refugees and thinking about, you know, if I was, like, you know, given 24 hours to leave this country and go someplace else, you know, what would I want to bring with me? You know, what seeds would I want to stick in my pocket? What things from home would I want to take? And what are those crops that would be familiar to me that I would want to grow if I landed in a new country, in a new culture where I didn't speak the language? You know, what would I want to carry from home? And I mean, of course, kale. I'm thinking I would have to grow kale, you know, because that would make me feel immediately at home. But what were some of the plants that you got introduced to from refugees that maybe you'd never thought of growing or eating in that way? You were talking about nightshades.
Yeah. So particularly our refugee entrepreneurial program had pretty much exclusively Somali Bantu refugees in it. So that was the program in which people were actually enrolled in winter classes, and we provided technical support and larger by scale compared to other urban agriculture plots. So our refugee entrepreneurial program got a fourth to half an acre to grow upon. And we also provided support in them going to farmers markets weekly. So they were producing quite a bounty of vegetables every week for 20-something weeks. And those farmers, so Somali Bantu, just to give a really brief history, the Bantu people are actually from Southeast Africa and were brought up in the 1800s via the slave trade to Somalia. And so when the Somalian Civil War broke out, they were the first people pushed off their land, as historically they had been slaves, even though they were not typically slaves by the late 20th century.
Culturally, they were very different.
Yes, culturally, they were very different. And they were also more typically farmers because that's how they had supported themselves in Southeast Africa. So it's very much a part of their cultural history and is something that they brought over to here to the U.S. with them. And so you see them bringing those kind of wild grown plants that are really nutritious. So things like amaranth, which they eat the young green leaves of, and also African nightshade, which they called mboga chungu, which is basically just like green vegetable. And I love
African nightshade.
So yes, because it is an African nightshade and produces these really beautiful dark purple, blue fruits, but does look like nightshade.
But you can eat it.
You can eat it, yes. It tastes just like spinach and has no levels of toxicity that you associate with nightshade, but is a hard sell to your supervisor.
Well, I could see that. I mean, bringing that to market, I mean, I had a hard enough time like growing some, you know, reasonably exotic things here and bringing them to market and trying to explain to people, no, really, it's good. You should eat it. But like bringing a nightshade to a farmer's market in America would be hard. Like, what did you call it?
Yeah. They're so good at introducing their crops and explaining to people how to grow them because, I mean, pardon me, how to eat them because food is just such a common and eating is just such a communal common experience. So, for example, I nearly died of giggling at one CSA drop-off because one of our farmers, Sophia, was explaining how to grow collard greens. That's another thing. They all love to grow collard greens, but are, again, a food in this region of the U.S. that is not very commonly eaten. And Sophia...
They can be a hard sell to people, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, people...
But they're delicious.
So good. Sophia would sell collard greens as describing the way you can cook it as, you know, fry it up with some oil, some onion, and some bacon. And I was dying giggling because Sophia was a practicing Muslim who definitely abstained from eating pork and had never eaten bacon in her entire life, but was just...
But she knew that was how to sell it.
She had such good customer service skills that she knew the way to get an American to eat their leafy greens was to put in some bacon grease.
Oh, man. Well, and I will say that that's, I mean, I certainly have done that as well. I mean, collard, and the sad thing is, I mean, collards are delicious. And it's a plant that grows really well here in this region. And it's a beautiful big leaf. I mean, it's very much like a big flat-leafed kale. And it has a similar texture and a flavor, and you can use it in a lot of the same ways. But there's something about saying the word collard. I think people, well, it's used a lot in the South. And I think people kind of cook it to death. Like you cook it until it's kind of mushy, and it often is with some pork fat. And I think people just have an association with it. It's like, ooh, collards, what's that? I'm not going to like that. But it can be so delicious.
What's funny, too, is the Swahili word for that kind of cooked greens dish is sukumawiki, which is translate to every day of the week. So it's
really?
Like, yeah, it's something that's seen as really nutritious and something you should be eating every day of the week. I have been in Swahili households where you can see, like, it's just like a kid with broccoli in the U.S. Like, they're kind of trying to avoid it on their plate.
So there are some universal things. I think that's just so, I mean, it just fascinates me, like, how people become, you know, when you move to a new country. And I mean, in some ways, I see it, people moving to this region from just another part of the United States, you know, and suddenly you're in an unfamiliar growing region. You're trying to bring something that's familiar to you. You're trying to adapt it to your new growing system. And I mean, those connections are so powerful, like how we connect to home. And those, did you learn some new recipes? Were there foods that you got introduced to that you now kind of like, I want to keep growing that?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm intrigued by this African nightshade. I don't know if it'll grow here, but...
It's great. Spinach is actually one of my favorite vegetables and something I love to grow. And it looks just like a spinach bush and is really fun to pick. And it was also fascinating. I tried to kind of prove that it was an edible, sellable commodity here in the U.S., and I could not find seeds anywhere. And I mean, there's a variety of seed catalogs in the U.S.
Really? So you just can't find a seed for it?
I just can't find it. And kind of the legend and that particularly growing community around it was a woman from South Sudan, and there weren't even that many Sudanese refugees in Boise, had brought it over as one of the few things that she brought with her when she came to the U.S. because it was something she wanted to be sure that she could continue to grow.
And so she brought the seeds, and then they just continue to save the seeds.
Yes, and then they've been proliferating throughout the community.
So I've got to go to Boise and talk to someone in the refugee garden there if I want to get seeds.
I couldn't even track down. And there was kind of maybe a little bit of a rumor that so-and-so had stolen it out of their field.
Wow. That's kind of amazing to think. Well, I mean, and that's what that also makes me think about how vulnerable sometimes plants are. You know, like if somebody stopped saving the seed for it, what would you do?
Yeah, no, I mean, it would disappear unless someone has a source. And please let me know if you know how to find African nightshade.
I'm going to start looking for that plant because that sounds really cool. And I like spinach too, so maybe we can grow that together. I'm intrigued by this work. I kind of can't wait to see what you do next because I feel like, do you think you'll keep coming back to some kind of, you know, connection with growing and connection with the land? It feels like something that you may try and get away from it, but it keeps drawing you back.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely always seem to be searching for a new wild place to live or... and definitely having access to the outdoors and working outside is something that's been really important to me. Is this something I really value. But it can be challenging being a farmhand, and it's always changing, but even a couple years ago when I worked, it was much more common to be paid under the table and not be paid minimum wage. And maybe, you know, you get free food, all the free produce you can eat from the farm, and maybe free housing, but it's debatable how what quality that housing is going to be.
I could see that.
Yeah. And so, and you also take a big risk sometimes when you sign up to work on a farm, because you're usually agreeing to live on someone's land and work for them. And there are certain pitfalls that can exist in that kind of situation. But I've been really fortunate and lucky. But it definitely, the seasonality of the work too can kind of wear on you as well.
I can see that. Yeah. I can see wanting to move something as you age, as you grow older, you wanting to move into something else. But just the connections that you've made and the stories that you have are so inspiring. And I think about that, you know, I think especially this time of year in the winter, as we look at, you know, in the holiday season, and we're thinking about how much we have and how much we don't have, thinking about, you know, refugees and what they bring with them and, you know, the immigrants that come to this community and what all the food that we value that's grown here, you know, so much of it has come from somewhere else, you know, as a packet of seeds in someone's pocket, bringing with them the traditions that they have. So I love hearing your stories about working with people who've brought those traditions. I'm going to hunt down some of that African nightshade. That sounds so cool. And I keep us posted about what you do next. I hope you stay in the area for a while.
Thank you. Yeah, me too.
Thank you so much for joining us for this week's In Season. And I'm looking forward to 2018 and looking for ways to connect you, our listeners, with growing in this region. So especially if you have any ideas or interests or topics that you want to see explored, please find a way to get in touch with me. You can always send me an email at teresa@46northfarm.com if you want to see a topic explored, and I'm happy to look into it. Thank you so much, and thanks to Joanne Rideout, our engineer, and have a great rest of your week.